देहं विपन्नाखिल चेतनादिकम् पत्यु पृथिव्यादय तस्य चात्मनः आलक्ष्य किञ्चिच्च विलप्य सासते चितामथारोपय दत्रिसानुने देहं बॉडी विपन्ना कंप्लीटली फेलिंग अखिला ऑल चेतना फीलिंग आदिकम सिम्पटम्स पत्यो ऑफ हर हस्बैंड पृथिव्या द वर्ल्ड दयेतस्य ऑफ द मर्सिफुल च आत्मनः ऑल्सो ऑफ हरसेल्फ आलक्ष्य बाय सीइंग किंचित वेरी लिटल cha and vilapya lamenting sa she sati the chaste chitam unto the fire atha now arupayat placed adri killed sanuni on the top. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada Ki. When Queen Aichi saw that her husband, who had been so merciful to her and the earth, no longer showed symptoms of life, she lamented for a little while and then built a fiery pyre on top of a hill and placed the body of her husband on it. Please repeat. When Queen Aichi saw that her husband, who had been so merciful to her and the earth, no longer showed symptoms of life, she lamented for a little while, and then built a fiery pyre on top of a hill, and placed the body of her husband on it. Purport. After seeing all the symptoms of life in her husband stop, the queen lamented for a while. The word kinchit means for a little while. The queen was completely aware that her husband was not dead, although the symptoms of life, action, intelligence, and sense perception had ceased. As stated in Bhagavad Gita, Dehinosmin yatha dehe kaumaram yovanam jara tatha dehantara prapti dhirastatra namuhyati. As the embodied soul continuously passes in this body from boyhood to youth to old age, the soul similarly passes into another body at death. The self-realized soul is not bewildered by such a change. When a living entity transfers from one body to another, a process generally known as death, a sane man does not lament, for he knows that the living entity is not dead, but is simply transferred from one body to another. The queen should have been afraid of being alone in the forest with the body of her husband. But since she was a great wife of a great personality, she lamented for a while, but immediately understood that she had many duties to perform. Thus, instead of wasting her time in lamentation, she immediately prepared a fiery pyre on top of a hill and then placed the body of her husband on it to be burned. Maharaj Prithu is described here as Dayeta, for not only was he the king of the earth, but he treated the earth as his protected child. Similarly, he protected his wife also. It was the duty of the king to give protection to everyone, especially to the earth or land which he ruled, as well as the citizens and his family members. Since Prithu Maharaj was a perfect king, he gave protection to everyone, and therefore he is described here as Dayeta. Om Jnanati Mirandhasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurunmilitam Jena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Mukam Karoti Vacharam Pangum Langhyate Girim Yat Kripatam Aham Vande Shri Gurum Dinataranam Paramananda Madhavam Deham Vipanna Akhila Chetanadikam Patyu Prithivya Daitasya Chatmanah Alakshya Kinchecha Vilapya Sasate Chitam Atharopaya Datrisanuni.
Uh,
So I had the opportunity to spend a week or maybe 2 weeks with His Holiness Lokanath Swami while we were working on a book together on Sanskrit pronunciation. This book is now published. I don't know if it's not widely available in the West yet, but it's out, and there's a copy in the Bhaktivedanta College Library. And he had asked me to come and help him with a few things in the book, and for that purpose, he had arranged a retreat of sorts in a little hut on a beach in a town near Bombay called Alibag. This is kind of like a retreat or resort type area where people come. It was a small little hut, and we were just on the edge of the ocean. A very nice place. And every day we'd work on the book intensively. And on the last day, it was the last day, next morning we'd both leave different places. So Maharaj, he asked me, would you like to come for a walk this evening along the beach? So I said, yeah, sure, that would be nice. And so it was already dark by the time we went out, and it was a beautiful evening. It was nice breeze, and it was cool, but not too cold. Yeah. And the tide was coming in. This particular place we were at, the tide would be out most of the day. So we never actually bathed in the sea while we were there, because the tide would be way far out. And then at night it would come, and it would come so close that it would, practically you sleeping, you could hear it lap near you. It was like you were sleeping on the in the water, very close. And the full moon was out, and we were far enough from Bombay for the stars to show. The lights were not so intense. So it was very nice scene. And Maharaj was in a reflective mood. And as we were walking, I noted the fact to him how the ocean used to come up to our doorstep every night. And yet we slept there peacefully, never thinking that we'd be submerged. It'd come a little too far and then, you know, we'd all be finished. It means the people had built the house knowing up to where it came, and we knew. And so I said, Maharaj, it's amazing how, despite how great the ocean is and how powerful, nevertheless, he respects his bounds very carefully. And Maharaj said, no. He said, it's because he respects his bounds so carefully. That is why he's so great. In other words, that he is big, that's true. That's objectively true. But that doesn't make him great. Just because someone is big doesn't make them great. He's big, yes. But what makes him great is, despite the fact that he's big, and he has the potential to sweep our little house away into the ocean in no time, right? But he respects his boundaries. And he won't move an inch beyond the boundaries that he's supposed to move. So, here in this verse, Srila Prabhupada is saying, Queen Archie should have been afraid of being alone in the forest with the body of her husband. After all, a dead body is a fearful thing, no matter whose body it is. When a person dies, it's very fearful to have that dead body nearby. And she was in the forest, and she was alone. Yet, Prabhupada is saying, but since she was a great wife of a great personality, she lamented for a little while, but then immediately knew that she had duties to perform. Because she was the great wife of a great personality. And I was thinking, well, what is it that makes her so great? Why is she being described here as the great wife of a great personality? And the clue to that is given in the previous verse. She's described there as Vrata Dharma Nishthaya. She who was fixed in the duties of her vow. Vrata Dharma Nishthaya. Vrata means vow. She who was fixed in the duties of her vow. And I was reflecting how these vratas, or these vows, are they are what circumscribe or create the boundaries of human life, of human civilization. As we know, every living entity in this world engages in the basic activities of life, eating, drinking, eating, sleeping, mating, defending, all those activities. But what makes human life so different and so special is that we engage in those same activities, but with the boundaries of vratas, of vows. And you look at the lives, the stories of all great personalities, and you find that these vows are what drive their life, or at least give it some shape or boundary. Look at the Ramayana, for example. We were discussing this in the previous class. Lord Ramachandra spent his whole life practically satisfying vows. He had not just his own vows, but the vows even of others. His father had given a vow that he would give three boons to his wife. And to fulfill that vow, Lord Ramachandra went to the forest for 14 years. He had taken the vow to have one wife and to protect her always. Eka Patni Vrata. Again, it's a Vrata. And he spent most of his life, or several years of his life, doing that as well. His whole life was bound by these various vows. Mother Sita had her own vows that she insisted on following. If you look at the Mahabharata, everyone, the whole story is practically driven because of vows. Everyone's got some vow on their shoulder that they're trying to carry. The most famous one, of course, is the vow of Bhishma. And this is why he's known as Bhishma, the terrible one, because of his terrible vow of Naishtika Brahmacharya. I'm not going to ever marry. And I'm going to be loyal to the throne till the end of my life. That combined with the fact that he had the boon of being able to die whenever he wished, it made for a very long and very difficult life for him. Normally that boon would be a great blessing, but he said, in my case, it's actually a great curse because I have to live with my vows, my terrible vows, for many, many more years than any ordinary person would have to. Bhima had his own vows, right? Very terrible vows, to tear open the chest of, or the, break open the thighs of Duryodhana, and tear open the chest of Dushasana and drink his blood. Draupadi had her own vows to keep her hair open until her insult was avenged by her husband's. Sahadev had his own vows to kill Shakuni. Gandhari had her own vow to keep her eyes covered and never see her husband, just as her husband had never seen her. Everywhere you look, practically, in all the stories of the great devotees and histories in ancient Vedas, everyone is working with a life full of vows. Because that is the character of human life. Right? That's what gives our life direction, gives our life meaning. We find, even in our own lives, right, Srila Prabhupada has given us various vows to practice. We have, of course, our vow to our spiritual master, that we will chant 16 rounds of the holy names every day and follow the four regulative principles for the rest of our lives. We have the vows we take in front of the fire for the sacred marriage ceremony, that we will be faithful to each other for the rest of our lives and protect and help each other on the path of Krishna consciousness. We have vows we find in the shastras made towards parents to serve them and to protect them. We find Sugriva and Lord Ramachandra making a vow to each other of friendship, that they will stick to each other in thick or thin. And they make that too in front of a fire. So, these vows are prevalent everywhere in our lives. And when these vows are pursued with determination, then these vows protect the person who's following them. Vows have this power, vratas have this power of protecting the person who is practicing them or following them. Prabhupada here is talking about protection. They protect us. Just like, for example, the vow of a husband to be faithful to his wife protects him by keeping him on the straight and narrow path of dharma. The vow of a wife to be faithful and chaste to her husband protects her from having her heart broken over and over again by various persons. The vow that we take towards the spiritual master protects us from the various sufferings or troubles that we find in material life. It's the ultimate protection. Right? It kind of gives us a lifesaver in the ocean of material existence. And the spiritual master says, here, catch it. I'll hold on to you. And we hold on to it, and it protects us that vow. Giving up intoxication protects us in so many different ways. Lord Ramachandra's vow protected. So everyone's vow, the power of a vrata or a vow is that it protects whoever is pursuing that vow. But not only does it protect that person, but it protects others also. And this is the wonderful thing about vratas. That it's not just beneficial for the individual, it can be pursued for oneself. But it also protects others at the same time. Just like Vasudev, he had taken a vow of protecting his wife at the time of his marriage, Devaki. That vow ended up saving her life. He reasoned with Kansa that, please spare her this time. And then for that reason, he gave a vow that I will give you my firstborn child and hand him to you to kill. And that vow, in fact, saved the child. Of course, only temporarily, right? Other things got... But in the short term, just the influence of the vow, if you look at it, it protected the child. Kansa was so impressed by him following his vow that he said, no, it's okay. I'm not afraid of this child. Take him back. When we pursue the vow we've taken to the spiritual master, it protects not only us, but protects everyone around us. The vow of the wife towards the husband protects him also, right? Just as it protects her. The vow of the husband protects her as it protects him. So this is the power of vrata, or vow, that it has the ability to spread this protection. And here, Srila Prabhupada is specifically talking about the vow of a king, Raja Dharma. That Ritu Maharaj, he undertook this vow to protect. This was his role, especially as a king. To protect his citizens, to protect his family, to protect his wife, and everyone who came under his shelter. And in that vow, in the end, right, he spent his whole life living the life of an ideal king. Someone who was protecting Dharma, who was living with his vow. And in the end, that vow ended up protecting him. Right? Here, he is on his path back to Godhead. And his wife is following very closely behind. Now, the ultimate of these vows, the most important that we make, we spend our whole lives tied down by these various vows. And that's okay, because this is what human life means. This is the purpose of human life. You cannot expect an animal to have a vow, right? We might feed a cat every day, but one day she doesn't come to be fed. To be expected. Because we don't expect faithfulness, perhaps from a dog, okay, closest thing to a faithful animal. But we don't accept vratas from animals. Right? This is a distinctively human characteristic. And we spend our lives tied down with them. But the most important of these vows, of course, is the vow we take to the spiritual master. We take to the spiritual master, to the Vedas, to Krishna himself, to the sacred fire, that from this day on, Krishna, I promise to mold my life in such a way that it brings me closer to you. I promise from this day on, I will make a sincere endeavor to put an end to my material life, to give up my material attachments and to engage in your devotional service. I may not be there yet, but from this day, we're committed. Diksha is like this moment. It's like a moment of marriage. Right? Okay, the work is just beginning. The time together is just beginning. But from this day on, I'm committed to you. Krishna, I'm yours. This moment is described in Chaitanya Charitamrita as a moment of where the disciple says, the devotee says to the spiritual master, to Krishna, my dear Lord, I'm yours. Tavasmi. From this day on, I'm yours. And you can do what you like with me. And when we make that vow to Krishna, then the wonderful thing is that Krishna makes us a vow in return. And there's an exchange of vows. It's a two-way thing. He makes us a vow in return. This verse is described in the Ramayana. It's quoted in Chaitanya Charitamrita to illustrate specifically this point of the moment of diksha, or commitment to a spiritual master. Lord Ramachandra, he tells his soldiers, the monkey army, when Vibhishana has left Lanka, he's been kicked out, really, of Lanka. And Ravana said, we don't want you here. And he comes seeking shelter on the other side of the ocean, where Lord Ramachandra has set up camp with all the monkeys and the bears. Then he begs them for shelter. He says, I have come here seeking shelter. I'm yours. And Lord Ramachandra, he answers. Many of the people think that these guys should not be trusted and they should be killed immediately. Several people give that advice. Taken prisoner or killed, or taken prisoner and then killed. And just kind of various combinations of the same thing. One of them suggests bring them down as friends, extract information about the opposite army from them, what Ravana is like and everything. Once we know everything, then kill them. Who's going to trust the brother of the enemy? But Lord Ramachandra, he has a different viewpoint. And he says this very beautiful verse. He says, Sakrideva prapanno yas tavasmiti chayachate abhayam sarvada tasmai tadam yetad vratam mama. Sakrideva prapanno yas. Even if a person comes to me once, Sakrideva, and he says, my dear Lord, tavasmi, I'm yours. Iti yajate. And he petitions me in this way, in a mood of surrender, prapanna. He comes to me and says, my dear Lord, I am yours. Abhayam sarvada tasmai dadami eta vratam. To that person, I give him shelter every day of his life. Abhayam sarvada tasmai. Every day of his life, I give him fearlessness. Abhayam. Eta vratam. This is my vow. Again, the same word, vrata. Right? So Krishna, he's saying exactly, he's doing a reciprocation here. He's saying, you made me a vrata, a promise. And I make you a promise in return. You promised me that from now on, your life is mine. To do with as I please. And I promise you that I will be with you every day of your life, protecting you. This is my promise. This is no ordinary thing, especially when it comes from Lord Ramachandra. He spent his whole life following vows. Right? This was, we know there's no limit to how far he goes to pursue his vow. Krishna, we might have some doubts. maybe has an objection here to my statement. Krishna is practically the only form of the Lord in which his life is not circumscribed by vows. He really shows that I'm not a human being. He says in Bhagavad Gita that I practice the path of Dharma, because if I don't, then all these worlds would follow my path and they would be put into ruination. But even then, he's not too good at it. He practices, his vrata is there, but his life is not bound by vratas. Because he's truly showing his role as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, as the Supreme Lord, whose position is, he is the only person in this existence whose position is beyond the control of any kind of vows. And so he's showing that, okay, the vow of marriage, yes, it's there, I'll practice it, but it's not too sacred, right? The vow of whatever it is, he doesn't very care about, I took a vow, right, that I will not lift a weapon on the battlefield. Okay, yeah, but it's, when necessary, I can break the vow. He shows his supremacy. He shows he's in control. There's only one vow that he refuses to break, that he doesn't break. That he's completely infallible in regard to that. And that vow is?
Declare it boldly.
Yes. Konteya pratijanihi name bhakta pranashati. That my devotee will never perish. I will always lift my devotee up from the ocean of material existence and take care of him. Yoga kshema vahamyam, I'll carry what they lack, I'll preserve what they have. Moksha ishyam vashucha, I'll protect you, don't worry. Over and over again in Bhagavad Gita, he says, look, this vow I promise you, this vow I promise you, this I promise you. You will come back to me, na sanshaya. There's no doubt in this. I promise you. this person will return to me, no doubt. That same Krishna is very convinced about. In other words, the same thing Lord Ramachandra is convinced about. That guarantee is there, and therefore Krishna is known as Achyuta, he who is infallible. Because in that matter he never fails. In everything else he may fail, but in that matter he never fails. That he never, ever, ever lets down his devotees. No matter what the situation is, he's always there to protect them. So this is Krishna's solemn vow. This is Lord Ramachandra's solemn vow. And what he's looking for us in our human life is a vow from our side. That, my Lord, I will do what it takes to get to you. In Buddhism, this is called the Bodhisattva vow. The Bodhisattva sits down under a tree and he makes a vow that I will not rise from this seat until I achieve enlightenment. I will not move, no matter, even if I sit here and die, I'm not going to move. This is my vow. This is the Bodhisattva vow. In later Buddhism, the vow even expands. And they say, not only will I not move till I achieve liberation, but I will not accept nirvana until every living being on this planet is liberated. And this is the Bodhisattva vow. Later on in Buddhism, it expands. I'm more compassionate. So the point is, Krishna is looking for this type of commitment from us. And as soon as he sees that commitment is there, then he makes a vow in return. So it's like a marriage. Initiation is like a marriage. It's a two-way contract between two individuals. Krishna said, the devotee says, Krishna, I'm yours. And Krishna says, the devotee, I'm yours. And together, they're on a journey back to Godhead. That yes, we're going to pursue this life as a commitment to each other. And then every other vow in our life, the vow a sannyasi takes for sannyasi, the vow a grihastha takes for being a grihastha, the vow of a brahmachari to remain celibate, right? Every vow in every stage of life is meant to serve this one vow, this one purpose of our commitment to our spiritual master and our commitment to Krishna. So here we find Queen Archie, Vrata Dharma Nishthaya. She was someone who pursued her vows. And therefore, she was the great wife of a great personality. Her husband did exactly the same thing. He pursued his own vows. Each one pursued their vows very carefully, with a lot of determination. And so in the end, both were protected by the power of their vows and protected by Krishna himself. A very nice lesson for all of us for leading a perfect human life. So I'll stop there. If there are any questions or comments, Manohar Prabhu has given permission today to go a few extra minutes. So we can take a couple of questions if there's some discussion. Yes, Prabhu.
Yeah, this power to the spiritual master, does it mean if you still have things you want to do for yourself, so, does it mean you cannot make this power?
If you have some what?
If you are not sure that you can give up certain things you would like to do, maybe in devotional service, like maybe you are a painter, you like to make paintings, but your guru is not going to ask you to do that. So,
yeah. See, the vow of Diksha is a vow that is basically, the minimum requirements of that vow are spelled out. The vow is basically this idea that my life is now committed to you. To show that commitment, there's a few basic minimum items that are spelled out. Following the four regulative principles and chanting 16 rounds of the Maha Mantra every day. This is our display of our commitment to Krishna and to the spiritual master. Beyond that, the details of the commitment can be worked out. They can be worked out with the spiritual master, they can be worked out with Krishna, they can be worked out with senior devotees. There's room, there's flexibility there. The nature of a vow is not that it's going to suffocate us. That's not what vows do. And sometimes we have a fear of taking a vow. That this is natural to human beings, the fear of commitment. That the vow will somehow suffocate me. It'll control my life to a point where I will have no life. This is why people often associate for years and never get married. Right? Or they come to the temple for years and take inspiration, but never take the step to make a commitment to Krishna. Because the commitment is what's fearful. We are afraid that the vow will suffocate us. But if we realize that actually the vow will indeed, it will actually free us. Right? It will actually relieve us. It will protect us. It will provide us a shield in this world. That a sannyasi's vow protects him. so much. Right? He goes into any situation. And he knows, and everyone knows, that there's a limit. Right? It's protecting him from certain types of association. You see what I mean? So when we understand that point, then the vow is not so fearful. We shouldn't be afraid. That yes, okay, the vow is there, but the vow is there to protect me. It will never harm me, that vow. It will only give me space to work and to function very comfortably. Things actually become more comfortable if we're properly situated in a vow that is appropriate to us. If we become more comfortable. A brahmachari who's going through a lot of mental, you know, disturbance. Should I be a brahmachari? Should I not? Should I be a brahmachari? What should I do? How should I relate to the girls? Should I talk to them? Should I not? Should I look at them? Should I not? Right? That whole, he becomes a grihastha. Right? Things, they calm down. Right? You're properly situated. You've taken a vow, but the vow protects you. Yes, I have one wife. I'm associated with one lady. Okay, things are comfortable. I can function now. I can do my devotional service with some relief. I don't have to be in an old mental situation all the time. So that's kind of the idea. The spiritual master will help us. This is the role of the spiritual master. To work the relationship out in such a way that we can pursue our goals. We can do, you can do what you want to do in serving Krishna. And through that purify yourself. And ultimately do what Krishna wants you to do. That's kind of the goal. Yeah, Krishna's commitment has no end. Right? Krishna's vrata, he's never actually broken his vow. For all we, you know, for all I've blamed upon him, he's actually never broken his vow. Life after life, birth after birth, Ishvara sarva bhutanam riddeshe arjuna tishtiti. Sarvasya chaam vidisan nivishto matta smriti jnana mampuhanam cha. I'm there in the core of the heart of every living entity, and I stick with them. From the time they're a worm, to the time they're an ant, to the time they're a demigod, to Lord Brahma. Right? In every form or every species, Krishna sticks with us. And sticks with his vow of protecting us, of caring for us, of giving us smriti jnanam and abohanam, of giving us remembrance, of giving us knowledge, and of making us forget when we need to forget things. Right? This is Krishna's commitment to us. And he's never gone beyond. He's never broken that commitment. Right? Imagine, he has to go through in order to maintain his vrata for us. What austerities he has to pursue, he has to accept cheerfully. He has to enter the body of a cockroach with us. Now imagine, the Supreme Lord himself, we look at a cockroach, and we do have no feelings but, I don't know, at least, you know, okay, maybe not disgust, but some feeling of distance, right? That no one goes, oh, cute little, oh, cockroach. No one does that with a cockroach. You don't do that with a cockroach. It's universally, or a slug, right? This area has so many, you go for a walk, you know, slugs crossing the path all the time. Oh, so many ugly creatures. Krishna's there in the heart of that slug, right? Spending time with him every moment, every day, as he wiggles his way around. He's sliming everything. Krishna's there. He's accepting that austerity. Because why? He took a vow that he's going to protect us. That even when we come to the material world, right, he will protect us. This is his vow. I will stick by the living entity. I'll take care of it. Even when he wants to think that I'm not there, I will allow him to think that I'm not there. And still, I'll be there. This is his mercy. This is his generosity. This is his selflessness and his commitment to us. Most of the time, when we do something to help someone, the very least we want is that they know that we're helping them. That they acknowledge that fact. That's the very least we like. And if they're not wanting that help, we say, okay, then, you know, Hare Krishna, please. Yeah. You can pursue your... I'm not going to intrude. Right? But Krishna is someone who says, we tell him, look, don't intrude in my life. I can deal with my life on my own. Krishna says, okay, I won't intrude. And he completely hides himself. And in the background, he's facilitating everything in such a way that we can very nicely think that he's not there. This is how generous he is, how selfless he is, and how committed he is to his vow towards us. I will protect this individual, even if this individual wants to think that I'm not protecting him. And move with him through body after body after body, sometimes in very sickening states, terrible states. The Bhagavad Gita talks about austerities that torture the self and the supersoul within. It means the supersoul is participating in our misery in some way. Right? He's conscious of it. Because the supersoul is conscious of our body, just like we're conscious of our body. He feels our body just like we do. The only difference is that he feels your body and your body, everyone's body also. But he's conscious very much of what's going on. And he accepts that suffering because he has made a commitment to us. So Krishna's commitment has no limit. It's endless. The extent to which he goes to protect us. What he's asking from us in return is actually very little. He's not asking a whole lot of inconvenience. Prabhupada said in Kali Yuga, this four regulative principles and rising early in the morning. He said, this is the only austerity I ask. In fact, he said that for rising early in the morning. He said, this is the only austerity we ask. That's all. That's it. Nothing really more than that. So what Krishna has to go through to keep his side of the commitment and what he's asking us, it's a very actually imbalanced relationship. Very imbalanced. But it's only thankful to Krishna's generosity that it works. In any other relationship, if it was this imbalanced, then you know one person would say, look, you're using me. Right? I'm being used, I'm being manipulated in this relationship. I'm not going to do this. It has to be a two-way affair. But with Krishna, he's willing to go, he's willing to give us a lot in return for relatively little. Yes, Prabhu in the back.
What could break a vow?
That's a very good question. What could break a vow? What could break a vow? You mean in terms of the individual, for the person pursuing the vow?
Yeah.
Many things could break a vow. But basically, Arjuna asked this question to Krishna in Bhagavad Gita. He said, why is it that the mind of a person and is carried away even by someone who is endeavoring to control his senses? Even a person is trying to live a life circumscribed by vows, and the person is carried away. And Krishna's answer is famous. He says, it is lust only. Mahashano mahapapma vidyainam ihavaitam. That is the great, all-devouring sinful enemy in this world. So it is our desires, our material desires, right, inside the heart, our conditioning, that pull us in the opposite direction, basically. Our mind, as a result of its conditioning, tells us that actually we can be happier if we step outside the bounds of our vow. That we can encounter some kind of a freedom as a result of that. And so we go on to explore. This is how we broke our vow to Krishna in the first place. We wanted that freedom to explore, to see how it is to live a life without the commitment, free of vows. And then we go stumbling along in the material world, and hopefully we learn our lesson. Hopefully we learn our lesson. Gopal Krishna Maharaj says something very nice. He says, we have been enjoying this material world, basically outside the bounds of our vows, in so many species of life, enjoying this material world for millions and millions of lives, going through everything possible, every experience in this world you can imagine. We've been through it. We've experienced the bliss of Brahma. We've experienced the bliss of a slug. And everything we've experienced. Just one life, Krishna is saying, give it to me. Just one life. And he's ready to give us eternal happiness. He's ready to take us back home, back to God, and free us completely. Imagine, it's just a matter of surviving, what, 25, 50, 60 years? And that's it. That's all Krishna's asking. And he's in return, he's willing us to hand, after millions of lifetimes of breaking our vow, right, we come back, basically it's akin to someone going off from a marriage and having a long-term affair their whole life, and coming back one day and saying, I'm sorry. And the other person says, oh, wonderful, please come home. Right? It's so nice. This is what Krishna's doing with us. We spend millions of lifetimes basically cheating on him. Right? This is what we're doing. We're cheating on Krishna. We had a relationship with him. We had a commitment with him. That Krishna, I'm yours. And we were in a relationship that is closer than the most intimate relationship we can imagine in this world. And we cheated on it. Right? We went out looking for happiness elsewhere. We said, Krishna, I don't need you. Imagine the hurt Krishna felt as a result of that. Imagine the pain he felt as a result of his own creation kicking him away like this. And millions of lifetimes, we turn away from him. We ignore him. We do what we want. And then one fine day, we show up and say, Krishna, I'm yours. 65 years in the course of a million lifetimes of devotional service, nothing. Right? It's akin to coming back and saying, I'm sorry. And everything's fine. And Krishna says, please come back. Of course, he's looking for sincerity. It's not a mechanistic, superficial process. In this sentence, he says, Tavasmi iti yajate, please, I'm yours. The key word there is prapanna, in a mood of surrender. One cannot come and just say, I'm yours in a mechanical fashion. Even that Krishna takes seriously. Even that he takes seriously. If we say it in a mechanical fashion. Krishna never, he always gives us the benefit of doubt. He always takes us too seriously when it's something about spiritual life. Because he's so eager for us to return. That sometimes even when we don't mean it, Krishna takes it seriously. In our temple in Boise, Idaho, we had one person who was coming to the temple just as a congregation member. He'd come and bow down before the deities and do some puja and parikrama like that, give a little donation. For many, many months and months, perhaps even years. And one day there was some kind of a lecture or class, and my father was giving a class, and he was sitting there. I mean, it's kind of like my father is talking here, and he was sitting there, right next to Prabhupada. And at some point in the class, he just burst open. Everyone was shocked, right? He just burst open. He just lost it. He just shouted, you guys, all you're ever talking about is Prabhupada, Prabhupada, Prabhupada. Right? This is all you ever talk about. Can you not talk about anything else? You're like, where was that coming from? He had never expressed it before. Somehow this frustration was building inside of him. Within a year after that, he was an initiated devotee. He's a disciple of Satsuru Maharaj now. And now he's doing amazing for years now. It's been, I don't know, 10, 15 years now. He's every Sunday, he's making the garlands for all the deities. Right? So faithfully engaged in devotional service. Prabhupada heard him. Right? Krishna heard him. It's like, and my father, after that happened, he said, this is it. This is the day he receives his mercy. Okay? He was sitting right next to Prabhupada. And Prabhupada went, excuse me? What? Did you call me? Right? Did I hear you call me? Of course you can come. Yeah. And he gave him the benefit of doubt, even though he meant something completely different. Like Ajamil saying, Narayan, Narayan, Narayan. Krishna said, oh, you called me. Right? Yes, I'm here. What would you like? No, it wasn't you I was calling. Right? But Krishna says, no, it doesn't matter. Right? It doesn't matter. Any excuse I can get to give you the benefit of doubt, I'll do that. So Krishna's very selfless in his pursuit of his vows. There's no one we can find more generous than he is in terms of giving us the benefit there. Peter Prabhu?
Yeah. You said that these vows normally protect or give some protection, but sometimes it seems some devotees, they give vows or commitment which they, after some time, it make them too weak, so that after they break higher vows like chanting or even sannyas vows. So how to...
Yes. That's a nice point, actually. Our vows are all connected. We should not separate them. Sometimes devotees think that the vow I've taken in grihastha life, for example, has nothing to do with my vow to my spiritual master. I can go on being a very nice devotee, but I can't maintain this vow. Or the vow I've taken for brahmacharya. Right? It's okay, but I can go on, you know... No, vows are all connected. Here we find Maharaj Prithu's example. His vow to his kingdom, his vow to his family, his wife, vow to his wife, were all connected. They're all tied. They're actually all part of one vow. If we break one vow, what happens is we lose the blessings of Krishna and the spiritual master as a result of breaking that vow. And therefore, we lose the ability to maintain all of our vows, any of our vows. We lose the strength. Because to maintain a vow is not easy. We see how much strength it took Bhishma to maintain his vow. He took this vow of Naishtika Brahmacharya. It's so difficult. Right? Where is the strength coming to maintain our vows? That strength is not solely a product of ourselves. Prabhupada says someplace, in regard to the vow of sannyas, he says it's nearly impossible, he actually says it's impossible, to conquer sex desire in this world. It's impossible. But by the mercy of the devotees, by association with Krishna, it can become possible. So the strength to pursue our vows, this is from coming from Krishna. We pray to Lord Balaram specifically for this, to Baladev, that please give me the spiritual strength to maintain my vows to my spiritual master, to Krishna, and so forth. So when we break any one of our vows that are taken in the presence of Krishna or the spiritual master or the devotees, then we lose those mercy, that those blessings, that protection. And so it becomes more and more difficult to follow any of our vows. And so often we find with devotees that a downward spiral begins with the breaking of one vow, sometimes not a very major vow. But that leads to something else, that leads to something else, that leads to something else. And pretty soon you know it, and all the vows are in shambles. They're broken. So it's a very important point. Very important point. That vows are all interconnected. They have to be... we have to see them as a unified whole. We can't separate them and say, oh, this vow is not so important. No, they're all unified.
I have a question. You were saying about how Krishna is very selfless and generous and everything. I was wondering, why does he love us so much? Like, why does he care so much that he's willing to take us back every time, even though we'd be disappointed?
Yeah. That's exactly the question for which there's no answer. Right? Because that is the meaning of selfless love. Right? Love that is free of motivation, ahoitaki. If ahoitaki means without cause. In other words, if you ask the question, why do you love? You can't answer that question. Because there is no cause. Like if you were able to pinpoint it and say, it is because, you know, this devotee cooks so well. Right? This is why Krishna loves him. Okay, he appreciates that exchange of love, but that's not why he loves. If you were a bad cook, then Krishna would still love him. You know what I mean? So, in other words, that is basically the unanswerable question. That basically Krishna's love is free of any... selfish desire, motivation, or cause, or reason. And this is why, you know, one can answer, generally speaking, that we're his offspring, we're his child. And so we can understand that from the perspective of a parental relationship in this world. Why is a mother practically willing to accept her child back, no matter what the offense? Is because that child is basically her own body, a part of her. So not accepting the child back is akin to her not accepting herself. It's like rejecting herself. If Krishna were to give us up, he's giving himself up. We're so closely connected to him. We're his own shakti, his own energy, that in essence he cannot reject us. Right? It's him. It's too close to him. So that way we can answer generally speaking that, okay, because we're part of him, because we're his own offspring, Krishna cannot reject us. But more specifically, we cannot answer that question because it is motivation-free, selfless love. And the same goes for the devotee. Why does the devotee love Krishna? It's not even because Krishna makes them happy. Sometimes we feel the bliss of Krishna consciousness and we become more determined as a result to pursue Krishna consciousness. It's so happy. Susukham kartum abhyam. It's joyfully performed, Krishna consciousness. And that's nice. It gives us impetus. But in the final, you know, matter of things, it is not even that happiness which motivates a devotee to love Krishna. This is why Chaitanya Mahaprabhu prays, Ashish Shiva Padaratam Vinashtuma. That you can take that happiness away from me. It's not as if Krishna has got us, you know, on... It's not like someone selling drugs, right? It's not like he's got us on a high. Unless he gives us that injection of bliss every once in a while, the devotee cannot love him. It's actually quite the opposite. In any circumstance, good or bad, happiness or distress, the devotee is willing to love Krishna. So that same love is actually present in us also. We have that capability of loving Krishna in the same way. But nowhere do we see it in the same proportion, in the same magnitude as we do in Krishna himself. Whoa, okay. I just wanted to take this opportunity to thank all the devotees from the bottom of my heart for your very kind hospitality and for your association. As always, every visit is a source of great spiritual rejuvenation for me. It's like I feel my kind of batteries being recharged, And it's very difficult to express the privilege and the honor I feel in associating with all of you here in Radhadesh. I leave tomorrow morning, so I just wanted to say thank you very much to everyone for giving me this opportunity to render a little service. When I was on that same walk with Lokanath Swami, towards the end of it, I asked him, I said, Maharaj, is there anything, as I pursue my life in Krishna consciousness in the future, I'm sure I have many things to experience, but is there any piece of advice you could give me, just anything that you think would help in pursuing a lifetime of Krishna consciousness? And Maharaj thought for a while, and he said, the only thing I can suggest, he said, is that we have to remain so packed up tightly in the association of devotees, so closely. He said, it's like going to the Kumbh Mela in Allahabad. When the moment comes to bathe, even if you change your mind that you don't want to bathe, you have no choice. The crowd will carry you and drop you into the Ganga. Whether you like it or not, you're going to be there. You're going to take a bath at the right moment. But that's if you stay right in the middle of the crowd. So he said, that's the key. He said, keep yourself right in the middle of the devotees, packed up. Right? Don't keep yourself on the edges or on the outskirts where you might accidentally get left behind. No, keep yourself in the middle. Then as we head all back to Godhead, right, you can be sure that you'll be dunked into the water, right, whether you like it or not. So I want to thank all of you very much for providing that opportunity, for keeping me tightly packed up in your association. I have some hope for receiving shelter at the lotus feet of Shishirada. Thank you all very much. Hare Krishna.